Overinvestment is not necessarily a bad thing, provided that it is eventually corrected. I'll always remember a news conference that Microsoft chairman Bill Gates held at the 1999 World Economic Forum in Davos at the height of the tech bubble. Over and over again, Gates was bombarded by reporters with versions of the question, "Mr. Gates, these internet stocks, they're a bubble, right? Surely they're a bubble. They must be a bubble." Gates compared the internet to the gold rush, the idea being that more money was made selling Levi's, picks, shovels, and hotel rooms to the gold diggers than from digging up gold from the earth. Gates was right. Booms and bubbles may be economically dangerous. They may end up with many people losing money and a lot of companies going bankrupt. But they also often do drive innovation faster and faster, and the sheer overcapacity that they spur, whether it is in railroad lines or automobiles, can create its own unintended positive consequences. That is what happened with the internet stock boom. It sparked a huge overinvestment in fiber optic cable companies, which then laid massive amounts of fiber optic cable on land and under the oceans, which dramatically drove down the cost of making a phone call or transmitting data anywhere in the world. It was actually the coincidence of the dot-com boom and the Telecommunications Act of 1996 that launched the fiber optic bubble. The act allowed local and long-distance companies to get into each other's businesses and enabled all sorts of new local exchange carriers to compete head-to-head with the Baby Bells and AT&T in providing both phone services and infrastructure. As these new phone companies came online, offering their own local, long-distance, international data and internet services, each sought to have its own infrastructure. And why not? The internet boom led everyone to assume that the demand for bandwidth to carry all that internet traffic would double every 3 months, indefinitely. For about 2 years, that was true. But then the law of large numbers started to kick in, and the pace of doubling slowed. Unfortunately, the telecom companies weren't paying close attention to the developing mismatch between demand and reality. The market was in the grip of an internet fever, and companies just kept building more and more capacity. And the stock market boom meant money was free. It was a party. So every one of these incredibly optimistic scenarios from every one of these new telecom companies got funded. In a period of about 5 or 6 years, these telecom companies invested about $1 trillion in wiring the world. And virtually no one questioned the demand projections. So when the dot-com bust came along, there was just way too much fiber optic cable out there. Long-distance phone rates went from $2 a minute to 10 cents, and transmission of data was virtually free. The telecom industry has invested itself right out of a business. Mike McHugh, Chief Operations Officer of Tell Me Networks, a voice-activated internet service, told CNetNews.com in June 2001, "They've laid so much fiber in the ground that they've basically commoditized themselves. They are going to get into massive price wars with everyone, and it's going to be a disaster." It was a disaster for many of the companies and their investors, but it turned out to be a great boon for consumers. Just as the national highway system that was built in the 1950s flattened the United States, broke down regional differences, and made it so much easier for companies to relocate in lower-wage regions, like the South, because it had become so much easier to move people and goods long distances, so the laying of global fiber highways flattened the developed world. It helped to break down global regionalism, create a more seamless global commercial network, and made it simple and almost free to move digitized labor, service jobs, and knowledge work to lower-cost countries. But the fun was just beginning. This phase was just the foundation for the next step in flattening the flat world. Flattener number 3, workflow software. Let's do lunch. Have your application talk to my application. I met Scott Hyten, the CEO of WildBrain, A cutting-edge animation studio in San Francisco that produces films and cartoons for Disney and other major studios, at a meeting in Silicon Valley in the winter of 2004, I had been invited by John Doerr, the venture capitalist, to test out the ideas in this book to a few of the companies that he was backing. Hyten and I really hit it off, maybe because after hearing my arguments, he wrote me an email that said, "I am sure in Magellan's time there were plenty of theologians, geographers, and pundits who wanted to make the world flat again. I know the world is flat, and thank you for your support. A man after my own heart." Hyten invited me to come and watch them produce a cartoon segment to really appreciate how flat the world is, which I did. The series they were working on when I showed up was for the Disney Channel and called Higglytown Heroes. This all-American show is being produced by an all-world supply chain. The recording session, explained Hyten, is located near the artist, usually in New York or L.A. The design and direction is done in San Francisco. The writers network in from their homes, Florida, London, New York, Chicago, L.A., and San Francisco. And the animation of the characters is done in Bangalore with edits from San Francisco. I needed to see Wild Brain firsthand because it is a graphic example of the next layer of innovation and the next flattener that broadly followed on the Berlin Wall, Windows, and Netscape phases. I call this the workflow phase. When the walls went down and the PC, Windows, and Netscape browser enabled people to connect with other people as never before, it did not take long before all these people who were connecting wanted to do more than just browse and send email, instant messages, pictures, and music over this internet platform. They wanted to shape things, design things, create things, sell things, buy things, keep track of inventories, do somebody else's taxes, and read somebody else's x-rays from half a world away. And they wanted to be able to do any of these things from anywhere to anywhere, and from any computer to any computer, seamlessly.